Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great this morning, David. I'm doing great. Nice to hear from you.
You are just about to go on your big, epic America tour that you do every spring. You're like a rock star, so you're about to leave on that. What's your first tour destination?
My first tour destination is home, David. I'm going to Boston this afternoon.
Excellent, excellent.
We're doing 19 cities in 16 days, not just in the United States, but also in Canada.
Wow, it's like a world tour.
Well, if the world were the United States and Canada, yes.
Yeah. Well, that's how often when rock stars do a world tour. There's often large parts of the world they exclude. Right. There was lots of news last week, but one story that might have gotten buried a little bit, but I think is worthy of some investigation, is a case out of Texas, the National Coalition for Men versus the U.S. government, in which this coalition... National Coalition for Men sued, claiming that the Selective Service was sexist and discriminatory, and that women should be required to register for the draft. And a federal judge agreed with him. Yesterday, in fact, a second federal judge issued a very similar order, arguing that women should all. This is a judge in New Jersey. Ordered that women should also be required to be eligible for the draft. And what jumped out at me, and I'm curious what you think about these, Frank, what jumped out at me in these two stories is one is the a men's organization claiming that it was discrimination that women aren't included in the draft. The other one is by a young woman who wanted to register for the draft and was told she couldn't because she was a woman. Is the ways in which these questions about who gets to serve in the military and who can be forced to serve in the military opens up all kinds of interesting historical questions about military service, both voluntary military service and involuntary military service, questions about gender in the military and how the military deals with questions of gender, and which has interesting parallels historically with how the military has dealt with questions of race. And so I thought this would be an interesting opportunity to talk about military service, who's allowed to serve and who is being forced to serve. Do you have any thoughts, Frank, on these two cases before we sort of dig into the history behind them?
Yeah, I've got a question for you, David, because I'm not sure I want to Google the National Coalition for Men. I don't think I want that in my search history. What do you know about this organization? Have you had the courage to Google it?
Well, I haven't seen anything beyond what's in the sort of news articles about the decision. So no, I don't actually know anything about the plaintiff in this case.
I mean, the men's rights movement, and again, I'm using air quotes here, is a slightly, I won't say dubious, but it certainly on both sides of the Atlantic, people who claim to be advocates for men's rights are sometimes problematic in their attitude towards women.
Yeah. I have a similar supposition. I mean, I don't know anything about this particular organization, but I have a similar reading on men's rights organizations and the ways in which they pitch themselves. The second case, though, with the young woman, I think she's technically actually 17, so she's just about to be eligible for the draft. Were she eligible for the draft?
Yeah, no. Eligible to register for selective service. Rather than the draft.
Yeah. This is not the first time a woman has tried to register for the draft and being told that she couldn't. And here we have a judge agreeing that. That the particular the selective service legislation is discriminatory in that it requires men to register and prohibits women from registering. So it's the legal outcome of these two cases is very similar, even if they come from slightly different places.
Well, not knowing anything about the National Coalition for Men, so what I'm about to say should in no way be interpreted as a comment one way or the other on that organization. I'm not capable of rendering a view. I would say it seems to me that if we're going to require young men to register for selective service, which is really kind of giving your information to the government in anticipation of a draft, it's not registering for the draft per se. That I don't think there's anything wrong with if the government is going to require that of 18-year-old men. I it seems to me, given the changes in the military in the past generation with regard to gender equality, it seems to me totally appropriate that young women should register for Selective Service as well. We may disagree as to whether people should. Anybody should be registering for Selective Service, but if registration for Selective Service is required, it seems to me that it should apply to women as well as men.
I would agree with you on that. Right, I think the gender politics of that is pretty clear. Right, if it is going to be required of, you know, if it should be required of everyone, if it's required of anybody. That being said, I'm a pacifist. I don't want anybody to go off to war, especially somebody who doesn't want to go off to war. But that's a slightly different angle.
Did you register for Selective Service when you turned 18?
Well, I of course, because partially because the law says you have to, and you're going to get fined some ridiculous, like $50,000 if you don't, go to jail.
Right, but nobody's been convicted since 1986, and the government's basically decided not to pursue this with anybody.
Yeah, no, so I registered, filled out my little postcard or whatever it was, when both of my sons turned 18, I helped them register for the draft as well. So,
I am not going to comment because I do not want to cause any legal difficulty for anyone in my family about whether I did that or not.
Okay.
With them. But having non-U.S. citizens – sorry, U.S. citizens living outside of the United States, it's a slightly more complicated process, I guess. my children are subject to being drafted in Sweden as well, so it's very complicated. I registered back when I turned 18, but it wasn't with the Selective Service. But I wasn't actually worried that the government was going to come after me necessarily.
So one of the reasons why this case jumped out at me in the news is I have a daughter who's just about to turn 18, so I thought I was done helping the children register for the draft. It turns out it may not be. It's unclear exactly with both of these cases what the actual policy outcome is going to be, even if both judges have decided that the current status is illegal.
The one thing that struck me, David, I know we have to get to the history of this, but in doing the research for this episode, I was struck by the fact that there have been no convictions for failure to register for Selective Service since 1986, and that the government essentially has decided not to pursue this, it seems to me, as a policy. But I'm wondering what will happen if and when we get a presidential candidate, for example, who – I don't know whether Beto O'Rourke, for example, registered or not, but when he turned 18. But – Will it matter, given the history we've had in terms of Bill Clinton's history with the draft and more recently President Trump's? You know, is this going to be a thing that doesn't matter, or will this, you know, will it be something that will be held against candidates in the future?
Well, I think it. I mean, right now the federal government hasn't prosecuted anybody for not registering for the draft, but there are other ways in which you are penalized for not doing it. You're not eligible for federal education grants, for instance. When you fill out the FAFSA, it asks if you registered for the draft if you're a man. And there are certain states that don't allow you to get a driver's license if you're a man over the age of 18 and if you, you haven't registered. Or at least you have to check a box or something.
So we have to tick a box, but I'm not sure that – I don't know.
I'm not sure they go back and check, right?
Joined up thinking there is on this. It seems to me that this is a system that that doesn't function very well.
Yeah, I'm curious. I don't know how many people are in charge of the Selective Service office in – I don't know how many government employees that occupies. It'd be interesting.
And you wonder whether the registry of motor vehicles in I don't know, Rhode Island is actually checking with the Selective Service office in Washington or not. I mean, I'm a – color me skeptical.
Okay. The legacy of especially the Vietnam era, I think, is something we'll need to talk about because, you know, I think there was a particular moment where people were finding ways around the draft, not so much they weren't registering, but that they were – finding ways to get exemptions, and that's obviously a whole category of people, some of whom have ended up in the White House. And that doesn't seem to have been held against them, particularly. At least that doesn't seem like either in the case of the current occupant of the White House or in the case of somebody like George W. Bush, who was in the Texas
Air National Guard.
Supposedly, although you know, there were questions about that during the campaign, I guess, or in the case, I guess, of President Clinton, who had educational exemptions, if I'm recalling correctly.
That's right. The interesting thing is, I mean, we made much of when George H.W. Bush died last year, much was made of the fact that he was the last president of the World War II generation. We're quickly going to be approaching the time when presidents are post-Vietnam. And so maybe this
was post-Vietnam.
Right. But where all the candidates will be post-Vietnam.
Yeah.
And maybe this just won't be an issue anymore, a political issue.
Yes, to be sure. Right. So when we think about military service in this way, in terms of who gets compelled to serve and who is allowed to serve, and I think those are part of two sides of the same coin. When we go back to your time period, who is allowed to serve in the military and who is compelled to serve in the military?
Well, most of the colonies, and we're talking about colonies then, not states, required some form of militia service for all adult men. And there'll be important qualifiers by race, which I'll get to in a second, of course. But most of them required, all adult men, and by adults, you're talking about males over the age of 16 and down to usually the mid to late 40s, sometimes later during wartime, were required to serve. Now, that's not to say they all did. There's an interesting variation regionally that kind of challenges some of our contemporary assumptions. I was talking to somebody here in Charlottesville about this just yesterday. So Massachusetts, for example, had more or less universal male military service. The analogy I made in this conversation with a friend yesterday was Massachusetts in the 18th century was kind of like Israel today, in that all able-bodied men, were expected to serve in the militia and pretty much did. And so it was, if you will, quite a militant place. And Massachusetts, which we don't associate with military service today necessarily, had a pretty robust military culture. And I think that can be extrapolated or applied to all of New England, in fact. Whereas in the South, it was more patchy. Now, of course, we associate in contemporary American culture and cultural geography, we associate the South with military service and the Northeast not so much. But we're kind of inverting some of our assumptions, I think, when we look at the earlier period. And at least in the North, there was more or less universal service. And in many cases, free blacks, and in some cases enslaved blacks, also served in the militia, at least during wartime. In the South, it's totally different. We've talked about this on the podcast in the past with regard to the Second Amendment, I think. In the South, the militia is pretty much a slave patrol. So, of course, African Americans, enslaved and free, were prohibited from serving. And the militia was as much about domestic policing as it was about protecting a colony or a community from external threats. Whereas in the northern colonies, it's about basically fighting the French and Indians pretty regularly. And so there's a kind of to a certain extent, one can talk about universal conscription or certainly universal service. People would be exempted if they were injured or old or infirmed or what have you. But there was a cultural expectation and a legal expectation of service that was more or less honored, and that will serve as the basis for the resistance to Britain in the 1760s and more importantly the 1770s, and when the War of Independence broke out in Massachusetts in the spring of 1775, those Minutemen were kind of who fought at Lexington and Concord were elite militiamen, but they were joined by militia from around New England within days of the first shots in April of 1775. And eventually Congress adopted them and appropriated them, and they served as the nucleus for the Continental Army. There was not conscription during the War of Independence in the way you would find it in your period during the Civil War, and we'll get to that in a second, so much as different states had different policies. So of the new states in the 1770s that were kind of trying to establish their existence and their authority whilst fighting for independence. And so what you saw was different states had different policies to raise levies, as they were called, for the Continental Army. In some cases, they loaned their militiamen. In others, men joined the Continental Army. But the Congress did not have the authority. It didn't have enough central authority to coerce either the states or the individuals who lived within those states to serve. So there wasn't a kind of formal draft, although some of the states had drafts to raise soldiers for the Continental Army. There wasn't a draft for the Continental Army per se. What we see after independence, immediately after, is there's a lot of concern about one of the causes of the War of Independence, of course, was a fear of standing armies and the danger that standing armies posed to individual liberties. That's one reason for the Second Amendment, for example. And there were concerns about creating too much centralized military authority. So the militia tradition lasts for a long time after independence. Although formally trained, there's a very small standing army in the United States. I mean, in the 1790s, it's only a few thousand men. There's great skepticism about the militia, but there's also a tradition of believing that the militia is the bulwark of American liberties. And that persists for a long time, indeed, down to your period. Yeah. There's James Madison talks about creating having a draft during the War of 1812 and wants to draft 40,000 men, but that proposal fails. There's a Militia Act in 1792 that talks about kind of service for people, for men between the ages of 16 and 45. And there's a kind of notional sense of national service, but it's still decentralized and with the states. And there isn't a draft per se as we understand the modern concept. The kind of modern draft, I think, starts in your period with the Civil War, of course.
Well, I have this image of the colonial militia, at least at certain points of it, where it's as much the annual militia muster is as much a social event as it is an actual military event. Am I wrong in thinking that?
No. That's true. Especially, I think it's more true in the South than up North because it's again where the danger of the French and Indians coming is more pronounced. You actually take militia service more seriously. But you know, militia muster days are pretty much, you know, these are men who work almost entirely in agriculture, which is to say they're often quite isolated. They work hard, and militia muster day is a day when people can come together and have a drink.
Yeah,
and they do. But that's, I think, led to a little bit of a caricature about the militia as absolutely useless, and I don't think that's entirely true.
Okay. Well, so I mean, if we think even about, since you mentioned the first real drafts, that is to say sort of compelling people to fight against their will, really is associated with the Civil War era, where both the Union, the Confederacy institute drafts. The Confederacy institutes a draft in 1862, the Union institutes a draft in 1863. Neither of these drafts are very popular. The Confederate draft, for instance, is unpopular in large part because the people who end up being drafted very often are poor white Southerners, usually not from the slaveholding classes. There's an exemption built into the Confederate draft that if you are in charge of supervising 20 or more slaves, you'd be exempted from the draft, which many poor white Southerners who weren't all that enthusiastic about the Confederacy to begin with, when they hear about this, and that it's unclear exactly how people were using this exemption, but the mere presence of it, I think, stoked up class tensions within the Confederacy. And the Confederate draft really was kind of draconian. They basically said everybody was in military service between various ages, and they sort of expanded the ages as the war continued. So everybody was in the military unless they were one of a handful of category of exempted men. And so it really was trying to sort of levy as many men to military service as possible. The Union draft was a slightly less heavy-handed. It was they had a quota for each state, how many people were supposed to be recruited from each state. And if they didn't meet the quota, then they instituted the draft locally there to meet the quota. But it was also deeply unpopular, especially in New York City, which had New York City was in some ways hostile to the Republican Party. It was a very Democratic city. It was a city with a lot of poor Irish immigrants, many of whom were very hostile to the idea of being forced to serve. There were ways in the Civil War in which you could purchase your way out of the draft. So if you were drafted and you paid a substitution fee of something in the order of $300, you could get out of the draft. But $300 is about as much as somebody, a working class person, made in a year. And so that was a price that poor people could not pay. And so the idea that you have to go off and fight in this war that rich people were not being forced to fight in to the same degree really antagonized poor immigrant men in New York. And when this leads to the New York draft riots in July of 1863, in which first they target the draft offices, but then after that they target African Americans in New York City, who they see as being, they look at African Americans in some ways as being the cause of the war, which is a interesting read on their part. But they're angry about the Emancipation Proclamation. They're angry at the federal government. And so African Americans bear the brunt of this draft riot in 63. And it's only when soldiers who had fresh come from Gettysburg does the draft riot get repressed. That being said, in the Civil War, almost something well more than 90% of soldiers in both armies are volunteers. So even though is a large draft, it is a controversial draft in both the Union and the Confederacy. Most soldiers are volunteers.
Right. So the Civil War gives us the first draft. It's not terribly effective, I guess you'd say, but it also gives us the first widespread draft resistance.
I think that's a good way of thinking about it. You do find the Confederacy, for instance, lots of people dodging the draft by going and basically becoming outlaws, people who take and live in caves or live in the mountains, who are avoiding the draft, either because they don't think highly of the war, or they don't want to harm their family because their family needs their labor for farming and other things. So there is pretty widespread, at least in some areas, resistance to the draft. But after the war ends, there is no draft. I mean, that the Civil War is one of those places where there's an exception to some of these things that do appear again in the 20th century. I mean, you also have an income tax during the Civil War, which again sort of then disappears and reappears in the 20th century. So the first, like, you know, we think about the modern draft, I associate that with coming with World War One.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I think is really when you have the system that we have today, the Selective Service Act, which is passed in 1917, the sort of structural system that we're still sort of living in the aftermath of, was put in place. And the origins of the draft, I think, in World War One is that when the United States gets involved in the war, Wilson calls for 1 million soldiers and only about 73,000 people enlist, which leaves them a deficit of some 900,000 people, right? So in part, it's a draft that emerges out of the fact that people aren't deeply enthusiastic about going off and fighting in trenches, because I think most of them knew what that meant.
Yes, I mean, the horrors of World War One were well known by 1917 on both sides of the Atlantic.
And, you know, one of the things about the draft, thinking about how it's put into place in World War One, I think they draft something in the order of 3 million people by the end of the war, is they don't have any exemptions the same way they do in the Civil War. You can't purchase a substitute the way you could in the Civil War. So they're responding that, you know, the World War One generation, some of them have memories of these things. Wilson, of course, had studied the Civil War and had written about the Civil War, in fact.
So they're consciously trying to address some of the limitations of the Civil War draft, aren't they?
I think they are. But at the same time, one of the things they're doing is they're really shutting down any dissent about the draft. So, I mean, this is happening in the same context as you have things like the Sedition Act that says that if you criticize the government, you can go to jail. And so, you know, people who are critical of the draft are in fact imprisoned. You know, one of the people who criticizes the draft is Eugene Debs, and he ends up going to jail for it. You know, lots of labor organizations are critical of the draft. The Wobblies are critical of the draft. Emma Goldman is critical of the draft. She says, look, the 13th Amendment says no involuntary servitude. How can you have people being compelled to fight? You know, isn't that involuntary servitude? And the court said, no, this is an entirely different category of thing. But I think the fact that you've got these government systems set up to minimize dissent about the draft at the same time you are imposing it, I think is part of the reason why the I don't want to say the draft was successful, but at least there was a minimum degree of disruption to the draft in World War I, despite the fact that the war itself didn't generate the kind of enthusiasm maybe that some other conflicts did.
Well, by that measure, then, it is successful. I mean, if the object of the draft is to fill the ranks of the military for during wartime, the World War I draft succeeds in doing so, not least because of the repressive measures that go along with it, I guess, that you alluded to. I mean, World War I is a fascinating – the American involvement in World War I is fascinating because it doesn't always get the kind of attention from historians that I think it merits, in part because it's relatively brief, but so much happens during that period in terms of the kind of aggregation of government power and the suppression of dissent and things. It's a really – I think it's quite significant. And if the draft in World War I reflects lessons learned from the Civil War, I think the other experiences of World War I, particularly with regard to government power, anticipate things we'll see later during the Second World War and, more importantly, during the Cold War.
Yeah, I think that's right. One of the things I think that's linked to the draft is also sort of who is eligible for military service, right? And so there's always questions in World War I about, you know, do you have to be a citizen to be drafted? Are you a resident? Does that make you drafted? Are African Americans eligible to be drafted? And it turns out African Americans were drafted, but you know, they fought in segregated units, and most of the African Americans who were drafted were forced into kinds of very difficult physical labor rather than more prestige roles within the military.
But there were lots also of recent immigrants who were drafted, both citizens and non-citizens.
Yes, that's
right. The degree to which the military actually sought to adapt to the – it's quite interesting. The kind of cultural requirements of different ethnic groups and putting ethnic groups together in military units was a result of that draft as well, which was relatively enlightened, I guess, for the early 20th century, particularly in a period of pretty – strong xenophobia. You know, World War I immediately precedes the crackdown on the so-called new immigration that's going to occur in the 20s. But at least because of the need for the necessity for manpower, the government made some concessions to and recognition of the needs and interests of newly arrived immigrants.
Oh, to be sure. How does, you know, when we get into the World War II draft, how is that different, do you think, than the one from the First World War?
Well, it's bigger, for one thing. But also, World War II, the Second World War, I think, was more popular in the sense that there were a greater number of volunteers, relatively speaking, than there were in the First World War. But it's I think the scale and scope of the Second World War means that it's just everything's done on a grander scale than what we saw. The American involvement, the U.S. involvement in the First World War is relatively brief. It's about 16 months. And although the United States is a relatively late arrival in the Second World War, the war goes on for about 3.5 years. And of course, the United States and the Roosevelt administration recognized that it was likely the United States would become involved in the war, you know, eventually, and began to plan relatively early. So there's a draft act in 1940, I think it is.
Yeah, Which is a peacetime draft, right?
Right. I think
that's so what's interesting about it is that they're you know, most of these other cases, the war breaks out, the United States declares war, and then they impose the draft when
that's right.
they can't meet recruitment by volunteers. The fact that they start starting a draft in 1940 when U.S. involvement is not guaranteed, but looks like it's sort of in the cards. Suggests a very different kind of approach to compulsory military service and the sort of idea of having a standing army of some size, which had always been sort of anathema during the Revolutionary era and during the 19th century, really has sort of gone out the window. And it's really sort of a start of a whole new phase of thinking about having a military. I mean, one of the things, if you look at the size of the U.S. military, throughout the 19th century, it's usually less than 10,000 people, and then it balloons during wartime, and then immediately shrinks back down. And here we're sort of making the decision in 1940, with instituting a peacetime draft to create a real standing, permanent standing army. And I think that's a permanent standing army that we're kind of with today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the great change, or a great change in American life, has been the kind of revolutionary era skepticism about standing armies is now entirely gone.
Yeah.
And you're right; it disappears in about 1940 or 41 or 1945 at the latest. And we now live with, what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, mm-hmm. and very few people question that. To be sure. And so I think that that represents a cultural change. But the draft was part of that, and a peacetime draft. I mean, I suppose it was a peacetime draft in the sense that the United States was technically at peace. It was a peacetime draft in the context of a world which was at war, and there was an expectation that the United States would be joining that conflict eventually. And so it's a little different in that way, but you're right. Prior to that, if we look at the history of previous American conflicts, the government did very little to prepare until the conflict actually came, until the crisis came, in which case they sought to expand very quickly. And that's, World War One is a good example of that. They were trying to avoid that, I guess, in the Second World
War. Yeah. And the other sort of flip side of the peacetime draft in 1940 is that when the war ends, they don't end the draft. They reduce the number of people that they're drafting, but the sort of system of compulsory military service continues on after 1945. And part of this, I think, is when the military planners are looking at the demographics, and they realize that there's the children who were born during the Great Depression are just coming of age, and there's a population dip then because people didn't have kids and they didn't have any money. They were worried, would we have enough people to fill the army if we needed to? And so keeping a peacetime draft was sort of part of that. And so you've got a peacetime draft throughout Korea, and then even after Korea, you've got, this is when Elvis gets drafted after the Korean War, as part of this peacetime draft, it has to serve his 2 years in the army and get his hair cut off.
Right, but we've got a peacetime draft in part because of that demography, but also because of the ongoing Cold War, which is is
both peacetime and not peacetime.
Yeah, that's right. So it's not unlike 1940, I guess. Yes, it's technically peacetime, but it's not really peacetime. And the United States at the end of the Second World War and throughout the Cold War has significant military commitments all over the world, and a military presence and a footprint, as they call it now, all over the world. So there are troops in Germany. I mean, there are to this day, and later Korea and Japan and so on. And so the U.S. military presence both expands, but also needs to be maintained, whether we're in whether the country is in war or nominal peace, I guess.
Yeah, I think one of the things there that's going on is that the draft had always been seen as being something that was an exceptional phenomenon. It was, to use a term that's been used too much recently, it was an emergency procedure, and now that sort of emergency procedure has been sort of embedded into you know, by the mid-1950s, that's part of the structures of government is having at least the structure of the draft in place, even if they aren't drafting that many people.
Well, and I guess, sorry, David. One of the things to think about is, you know, the Cold War from 1945 to 1989 or 91, whenever you choose to date it, could be seen as a permanent emergency, an ongoing emergency. That kind of warped American institutions and development because it lasted for so long.
Yeah. Well, so I think we need to talk about the Vietnam draft, because I think that's really a, you know, a critical, especially in thinking about sort of the current political climate, because we've got a lot of people who both served in Vietnam and didn't serve in Vietnam in our leadership classes today. Why was the draft so controversial in Vietnam? What was it about the draft that made it as divisive? Because I think the draft in Vietnam was more divisive than it was in World War II, and maybe, you know, it was divisive in other wars, as we talked about. But what made the Vietnam War draft so controversial?
I think the draft is controversial because the war is controversial. I mean, to a certain extent, the Second World War, you know, the Greatest Generation and all that sort of stuff, there was dissent during the Second World War, but nothing like what we see during the Vietnam conflict. And because the war in Vietnam is unpopular, I think the draft is unpopular, and it's compelling people to serve in a war that was controversial and unpopular and many people felt was unjust. Add to that the way the draft has evolved during the subsequent decades. It's been refined. There are deferments and exemptions for there are medical exemptions, of course, as President Trump would learn, but there are also educational exemptions as well. And so there's a sense in which I think by the late 1960s, for example, 68-69, that there's a perception that not only is the war unpopular, the draft is compelling young men to fight in a war that many feel is unpopular and unjust, but also the system is rigged against the poor in particular, but also non-whites. So poor whites and African Americans and Asian Americans and Latinos are much more likely to not to get drafted, because theoretically the draft is just a number system. You register, your number comes up. That should be random. But the, in terms of the people who have the ability to game the system to gain an exemption or a deferment, the deck is stacked. And so you know, one hears echoes in the Vietnam War of the criticisms one heard back during the Civil War, that this is a rich man's war and a poor man's fight.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You know, and so I think all of those things come together. The system has evolved in the you know, the in the years since 1917, when the first Selective Service Act was adopted, to it's become much more fine-tuned, and so exemptions are arguably a good thing and making allowances for people, but it's also, I think, perceived as being unfair. And then when you factor in that the war itself was unpopular, and as the years go on, it's apparently a losing struggle, and so you're risking your life and you may well be killed for a lost cause, I think all of those things conspire to make the draft during the Vietnam War very, very unpopular. And consequently, we see the return of really overt draft resistance. I think during World War I and World War II and Korea, what you saw was some draft resistance. I mean, you cited some examples from World War I, like Debs and Goldman and so on. You got it from the extreme left, which was relatively small in American politics for much of the 20th century, or from religious groups, so the Mennonites, the Amish, and so on, who resisted on grounds – well, all groups are resisting on grounds of principle, but, you know, on religious principle. Those were minority voices during the earlier conflicts. I think when you get to the Vietnam War, it's much more like what one sees during the Civil War. It's widespread because there's a widespread perception that – the conflict itself is unfair and the draft is unfair. And so we get people, you know, famously some will flee to Canada. Those men are kind of making a really overt political statement.
But there are 100,000 of those men.
Yes,
so it's
no,
not
a lot.
An insignificant.
Yeah. But you know, that's a kind of positive, if you will, political statement at great risk. Whereas others are either just avoiding the draft and the way that, learning to do it the way Bill Clinton did, or Donald Trump, or trying to stay off the grid, as it were. But it's very, very controversial. So the draft becomes very controversial as a result of the Vietnam War. I think it's this, in answer to your original question, David, why is the draft unpopular? It's because the war is unpopular. And as a result, the military, the U.S. military in the 1970s will give up the draft and go to a kind of professional force, and it retains that to this day.
So, I mean, we can think of, you know, Muhammad Ali being drafted in for Vietnam and trying to get an exemption and being refused the exemption, and then eventually going to jail briefly and losing his title as a consequence of that. Two of the best songs from the, I guess, the late 60s and early 70s are about the draft. I'm thinking here about CCR's Fortunate Son, which has been played probably in too many movies since then, but I think sort of speaks to that question about certain people being able to play the system because they have a private doctor or they've got access to education that allows them to escape the draft. And slightly less well known because it isn't in as many movies, Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant, which is about the draft, although it doesn't talk about the draft for the first 15 minutes of the song. He does about 15 minutes into the song say, "But that's not what I came to tell you about. I came to talk about the draft." But that's a song about a guy who was arrested for littering and was told he wasn't eligible for the draft as a consequence of that, which I think is great. So when we, you know, the U.S. government switches to this at the end of Vietnam, they make the decision to switch to a professional military to, you know, not draft people, but they still have this system in place. And I'm curious what you think the sort of the rationale then is for both having the structure of the system in place, even if it's not likely to be exercised anytime in the immediate future. What's going on there, do you think?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. In part, let's not underestimate the importance of bureaucratic inertia. So the system's in place because it was in place
since 1917. So it's
right.
Like 100,
and
okay,
so
good.
You know, we've had it, and there are people who work for the Selective Service, and they go to, you know, they go to their offices every day, and they do their jobs, and they have pensions and mortgages and everything else. And so, so it's in place because it was always in place. The other thing is, you know, let's not forget the legacy of the Cold War, which I talked about before, and the belief that, you know, it might be necessary in the event of a truly national emergency to draft lots of young men. I mean, the Selective Service registration became controversial during the Reagan years in the context of stepped up U.S. military action, both official and sort of unofficial, in Central America in particular. And there was a kind of belief then, I mean, that's when I had to register, that, you know, oh, you might have to go to El Salvador or Nicaragua or something like that. I mean, I don't think it was ever serious. But I think the Selective Service continued in part because of the perceived need or possible need for to institute a draft in the event of a real national crisis, especially, you know, again, the Cold War was still on, a war with the Soviet Union. The other reason I think it's persisted is to give people a stake, if you will, in what the government is doing. I mean, one of the things we've seen, and I think this has become really pronounced since 9/11, since 2001, is the United States has a very, very large military presence, but it's professional. And so as a consequence, despite the huge military footprint the U.S. has globally and even within the country, very few people serve in the military. So we have lots of post-Vietnam rhetoric about thanking people for their service, and you know, I went to a hockey game last week in North Carolina, and at the beginning of the game on the Zambonis, you know, the machines that clean the ice, as they were going around right before the first period, There were Marines in dress uniforms kind of sitting next to the drivers, waving to the crowd. There was a patriotic display at the beginning of the game. We've talked about the history of the national anthem before. There was a moment during the game when we stopped to honor a retiring service member and thank him for his service. This kind of thing has become routine, the kind of valorization and celebration of military service in American life has certainly become routine since 9/11. And it's a response to the backlash against the military during Vietnam. But what interests me about this is Americans engage in this behavior and engage in this culture of celebration whilst very few Americans actually serve in the military. That's because, and so I think,
and not only that, there are increasingly, there's, you know, the ways in which these communities develop, you know, there are lots of Americans who don't know people who've served in the military, right? And so the distance between, you know, the sort of military component of the population and the sort of civilian is that gulf has grown in a way that's really unprecedented, at least in the 20th century.
You know, that's right. I mean, you know, in 1960, you know, in the aftermath of the Second World War and Korea, I think if you went into any community in America, most of the adult men would have either had military service or would have worked in war-related industries and thus been exempted. But it would have been almost universal. Today, that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not – don't misinterpret me. I'm not saying, oh, those were the good old days. We should go back to that. But it's simply an observation. So I think in part – I mean, your original question that prompted this riff from me was why do we still have selective service? I think we have it so that at least there's a notional connection that we all have to – as Americans to the country and to this system. And so I think that's part of it. I don't think that's the most important part. I think it's just persisted because of bureaucratic inertia. And the possibility of a national crisis. Well, we've been at war. The United States has been at war continuously since 2001. But as you know, although some people, particularly on the left, ironically, have talked about reinstituting the draft and the belief that if the U.S. had reinstituted the draft, everybody would then have a stake in these conflicts and would take them more seriously. So it's been this kind of interesting tactic, because I think that people who are opposed to military adventurism have talked about re-establishing the draft so that the country would be more careful about using its squandering the blood of its young men and women.
Congress would be less willing to send the army, you know, the military into danger if their sons are in the army.
That's right. But that's not a serious movement, though.
No. But I think it's an interesting sort of, you know, thinking about the one of the things that gets the when Emma Goldman's, you know, sued about the draft in the First World War, one of the things that the court said when they struck, you know, threw her case out, was they said, you know, military service is one of the obligations that citizens have to the Republic. You know, the Republic has obligations to its citizens, citizens have obligations to the Republic, and fighting for the Republic is one of those obligations. You know, and we're, you know, living, you know, in the, now that the Vietnam generation is, you know, getting older, you know, the memory of that kind of relationship with the state that is fading into the background, and people often don't think about their relationship with the state in those terms.
Yet it's a staple of Republican thinking and Republican ideology going back to ancient times, of course, that they you know, one of the fundamental responsibilities of the citizen.
Small R Republican,
is, you know, military service and service to the state.
You know, one of the things that struck me with these cases is the ways in which thinking about the, you know, the not only the history of the draft, but the history of women in military service. And it seems as if, and I'm still trying to puzzle this out, you know, there's a way in which you can chart women's military service relative to the draft, because you start to find a lot more women getting involved or being allowed access to things in the military. That's been increasing rather dramatically in the years since the draft ended. You, of course, have women serving in the military in every American conflict. You've got women like Deborah Sampson from the Revolution. You've got a number of women who fight in the Civil War. They fight dressed as men, but you've got lots of women working as nurses and other kind of support capacities in both the World Wars. But, you know, I think it's not – it's interesting to me that you have West Point admitting women in 1976. And obviously they're doing this in response to the end to you know, the rise of feminism in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s. But the fact that West Point is admitting women at the same point that the draft is ending and the Vietnam War is over, I think is interesting. And obviously the role of women in the military has increased dramatically in the 40 years since women were first admitted to West Point.
Well, if you have a volunteer force, you need to make sure the pool of volunteers is as large as possible.
Possible, to be sure. You know, we've seen these debates about sort of what throughout the 80s, 90s, and more recently debates about if we're going to have women in the armed forces, what role should they have? What are the, you know, we've now reached a point, and I think this is sort of the background to some of these cases, is that you know, women are able in the military now to serve in all the roles that men are. So they're able to participate. Since 2013, I think, was really when they started to change the policy on women in combat. And I think that's so I think we really sort of an interesting moment then in terms of both the trajectory of women's military service, but also in terms of, you know, how one thinks about who gets to serve and who must serve in the armed forces.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we'll see how all this plays out. We'll see whether I have to register my daughter in the next few months.
If you do, I think it's still highly unlikely she'll be drafted.
I think that's the case. Yes. For all kinds of reasons. anyway, I'm a pacifist. I hope nobody has to fight, but nonetheless, what's your last drop, Frank?
Well, I want to highlight the trip I'm about to go on and give a shout out to my colleagues, in Edinburgh's international office, which is called Edinburgh Global. So we are about to, as I said at the very beginning of our chat, do a series of events. In fact, the first of those events was in Toronto last night, or Toronto tonight, I should say. We're going to 19 cities in 16 days across the U.S. and Canada. These are information sessions for applicants to Edinburgh University. We're going to see about 1,200 people. And the team I work with, which are Scott, Mary Kate, Ali, Sarah, and Tessa, do a great job. They're a lot of fun to work with. So what happens is we're going to be together for some of the larger events. Most of us will be together for some of the larger events, and then we split up into smaller, you know, pairs or trios and do, and in some cases, individuals, events in different parts of the country. And so we are going to – so I'm going to Boston today. We're going to be in Boston. I'm going to be in Boston, New York, Washington, Seattle, Portland, Eugene, Sacramento, Berkeley, and San Francisco in the next week and a half. But what I would suggest to people, listeners, if you're out there and you want to come to one of these events, it's not too late. So if you go to the Edinburgh Global website, you can find information on the events and where they're being held and when they're being held. And by all means, please come out and see us. But it's a lot of work being on the road. I have a great deal of respect for my colleagues in Edinburgh Global who do this regularly. I just come in once or twice a year and do it, but they do it all the time. But it's also very interesting. You see a lot of the country, you meet people from all different parts of the country and different backgrounds, and that's really good. But it's also a lot of fun. So a preemptive, and it also is the reason I don't know. I will be recording hopefully sometime next week. I'm not sure where or when, but we will be. But and
from the road,
from the road, hopefully. So I'll have tales of the road, hopefully, to tell you. So that's my last drop. What about you, David?
I just got two things. One, last weekend was SASA, the Scottish Association for the Study of America, annual conference. This was the 20th annual SASA, and so I just want to say thanks to everybody who came out, and thanks to everyone who helped me organize it. We ended the conference with a roundtable with a couple of the organization's founders talking about what it was like studying the United States and Scotland in 20 years ago, and not why they founded this organization, the whole thing. And they showed Rodri Jeffries Jones, who professor of American history, now retired, showed the program from the first SASE, which was much smaller than what we had over the weekend. But one of the events I noticed on the first SASE schedule was the release party for one of your earlier books, Frank. So your American your Revolutionary America, I guess that would be the first edition, came out 20 years ago. So,
oh my gosh! Yeah.
So you were there, not in person, but in spirit, as part of a historical artifact. So that's good.
Well, that is my future, of course. My future is the past.
that is all of our futures, is to be artifacts. But the second thing I want to endorse was a book that I finished last night that Ida and I, this is one of the things that Ida read to me, so I guess she was actually doing the reading and I was doing the listening. It was a book called Educated by Tara Westover, which is a memoir written by a young woman. I think she's in her late 20s, early 30s right now. I don't know exactly how old she is. But she grew up in a fundamentalist Mormon household in rural Idaho. Her father is a conspiracy theorist, end of the world, survivalist kind of guy. So if you're thinking about sort of Ruby Ridge sort of worldview, that's the kind of family she grew up in. There were lots of guns, a rejection of the federal government and of modern medicine. So she grew up in this very isolated world, but then decided to leave her family, which was abusive in all kinds of ways, go to college, and she ended up getting a PhD from Cambridge in history. And so it's a very interesting narrative about how she sort of came out of this particular insular bubble and how she learned how to sort of see the world in new ways. And the fact that she's a historian, and she's a historian of the 19th century United States, I thought was particularly interesting. That's not the main point of the book, but reading it as a historian writing about, she's a historian writing about her own life, I thought was an interesting, that was an interesting level for me to read it on.
Excellent. Does she express any regrets that she didn't come to Edper?
No, that was not. She went to BYU for undergraduate, and then somehow she got hooked up with people at Cambridge. I think she got a Gates scholarship to go to Cambridge, and then hung around there for a while.
Well, if you can't go to Edinburgh, Cambridge isn't bad.
Yeah, it's a good sort of backup. All right.
Excellent.
Lost David, our listeners in Cambridge.
Yeah, right. Sorry, Cambridge, we're joking. We're joking. It's that well-known American irony.
Great. Talk to you next week, Frank.
See you from the road, Dave. Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.